This week on The Score, why does immigration policy reform seem so impossible? What did we learn from the latest Labor Department jobs report? We visit some highlights from 2018, including interviews with authors and Virginia state legislators. All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere.
My fellow Americans, tonight I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border. Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. We are out of space to hold them, and we have no way to promptly return them back home to their country. America proudly welcomes millions of lawful immigrants who enrich our society and contribute to our nation. But all Americans are hurt by uncontrolled illegal migration. It strains public resources and drives down jobs and wages. Among those hardest hit are African Americans and Hispanic Americans. Our southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Every week, 300 of our citizens are killed by heroin alone, 90% of which floods across from our southern border. More Americans will die from drugs this year than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. In the last 2 years, ICE officers made 266,000 arrests of aliens with criminal records, including those charged or convicted of 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sex crimes, and 4,000 violent killings. Over the years, thousands of Americans have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered our country, and thousands more lives will be lost if we don't act right now. This is a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart, and a crisis of the soul.
As this episode of The Score goes out over the airwaves, the federal government is 3 weeks into a partial shutdown, sparked by an impasse between the President and Congress over spending billions of dollars on a wall on the border with Mexico. I spoke with David Beer, an immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute in Washington, about U.S. immigration policy and the contradictions that pull legislators left, right, up, and down as they fight for new ways to refuse to compromise. If there were problems with the tax code, Congress would pass a new tax code or fix them. If there were problems with, you know, transportation policy, Congress would fix transportation policy. Why does it seem that immigration policy is such an intractable problem that Congress can't deal with it?
Well, I think it's because there are so many issues that are interrelated when it comes to immigration policy. You know, you're dealing with border security on the one hand, you have visa issues on the other, you have a population of people who've been living in the United States without legal status for many years, and all of these issues get combined and conflated, and they have different lobby groups who are emphasizing each component, and no one wants to see anything move unless their issue is part of it. And so that ends up really holding up things that would have bipartisan agreement, you know, in favor of approaches that are more partisan and divisive.
We're talking to David Beer, who's a immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Last night, as we're speaking, President Trump made a national address on immigration policy. What was your reaction?
Well, I really thought that the president is portraying the border security challenges that the country does face as sort of being unprecedented, out of control. And there's certainly some truth to the sense that there is a humanitarian crisis at the border. The number of children who are coming, the deaths that we've seen occur at the border. I mean, these are things that Congress really does need to address. But by turning these real issues into a security concern, that this is about criminals coming into our country and murdering thousands of Americans, which is one of the lines from his speech last night. I mean, this is not the correct lens through which to see border security. I mean, Border Patrol publishes numbers of the number of criminals that it apprehends at the border. And its reports for 2018 indicate that just 1,000 of the more than 400,000 people that it brought into their custody last year had violent criminal histories, violent criminal convictions. So that's a tiny slice of the big picture here. And by focusing so much on that tiny slice, and I agree that the Border Patrol needs to keep violent criminals out of the country, you're ignoring, though, 99.9% of the problem, of the issue. And that's really the thing that I took away from President Trump's message, which was sort of, you know, a bit divorced from the reality at the border, which is not a bunch of young men who are part of MS-13 trying to sneak in, but women and children who are willingly turning themselves in to Border Patrol in order to ask for asylum in this country.
Isn't the humanitarian crisis that the president spoke about largely the creation of Trump administration policy?
I think that the president has certainly exacerbated this issue really in the one specific way. His administration has institutionalized a practice of saying, we are not going to take more than 5,000 families at legal ports of entry per month. And really what that has done is it has forced families to have either a choice between either living in Mexico, in Tijuana and other cities along the border, homeless and in dangerous conditions, dangerous parts of those cities, or their other option is to cross the border illegally, many times in remote areas of the border. And, you know, crossing in more remote areas, in deserts or crossing the Rio Grande, those decisions do place migrants at greater risk. And so the focus for this administration should be increasing those capacities at ports of entry, letting asylum seekers apply at those ports. And that way you're really funneling people into the legal process. It's a controlled system. We get to do background checks. We get to do health checks. We get to decide, do we want to detain this person? Do we want to put an ankle bracelet on this person? Or do we want to deport this person right back to their home country? That puts really the government in control of the situation. And right now, they're not in control. It's really a chaotic situation caused by policy choices.
The wedge issue that President Trump has presented to us since the campaign in 2015-2016 has been building a wall, which may now be steel slats at the request of the Border Patrol. there are 8 members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, who represent districts that border Mexico. All of them are opposed to the wall. What does this say about the practicality of building a wall and whether it's politically viable?
Well, I think it shows that communities along the border aren't being affected in the way that the president portrays them on national television. He talks about crime and criminals invading our country. That's not the reality. The reality is that counties along the border have much lower crime rates than the entire United States does. And if you look at where the border wall is going to be built, the border wall and border fences that have already been constructed are not built on the physical borderline between Mexico and the United States. It's built significantly in the interior of the country that cuts through private property, private lands. You're talking about ranches. We're talking about communities in some cases where they're actually on the other side of the border wall, and they're essentially living on the Mexican side of the border wall, even though they're part of the United States. And so then they have to have, you know, cross between the fence and have the value of their land depreciate. And, of course, their land is being taken by the government. And so that's really why you see opposition to the border wall in these communities. It's not that they want illegal immigration. It's that the border wall itself is going to have a negative impact on their communities. And illegal immigration and illegal immigrants, by contrast, are in many cases contributing to their communities. They would prefer to see that flow being legal. They want to see legal immigration rather than illegal. But they understand that many of these people are actually contributing to their communities, and that the real solution to all of this is legal immigration processes where people can come through a legal procedure without having to cross the border illegally, subject themselves to all kinds of risks, as well as have the U.S. government have to expend resources to track and surveil and build border walls and all the rest.
The president has talked about cutting off aid and trade with countries in Central America until they stop, quote unquote, sending their people to the United States. Would that make the situation worse or better?
I think it would have sort of an ambiguous effect. On the one hand, a lot of the aid that we give to the Central American countries goes into a very corrupt system. I mean, they're going to governments that are oppressive, that are dysfunctional, that are corrupt. I mean, this is why you have really chaos and poverty in Central America. It's not, you know, it's their dysfunctional governments that are causing the problem down there. And so more money to these dysfunctional institutions is not necessarily going to be the answer. Now, some of that aid does get to the right people, and that does have an effect of improving economic conditions for some people. But on the other hand, it's also aiding the corrupt governments, corrupt police forces, and so on. So it's a real mixed bag, and I don't see that aid necessarily contributes or doesn't contribute to preventing, you know, illegal migration one way or the other.
We're running out of time, but I have one final question, and that's about the government shutdown. Has itself shut down some of the immigration courts and reduced the spending available for border security, which is ironic. There's this huge backlog of cases that immigration judges have to hear, and yet the president wants to continue the shutdown. What's he thinking?
Well, I think he's betting on really Congress giving him everything that he wants, and then that's going to have such a great effect that it's going to overwhelm the negative effects that you've listed. I don't think that's probably likely to happen. I don't think the positive effects that he's expecting will occur from his policy suggestions. But you're right. I mean, it's really, we're talking about 800,000 people who are waiting for their case to be heard before an immigration judge. And that is building by the tens of thousands every month. And so the longer this shutdown goes on and cases aren't being adjudicated, is, you know, you're just really adding to an already dysfunctional mess that eventually I would hope Congress gets around to fixing.
Well, David Beer, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your comments today about immigration policy, and I hope we have a chance to talk again in the future sometime.
Thank you.
Happy New Year from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Last week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics issued its monthly report on jobs and employment. The December report showed an addition of over 300,000 new jobs. At the same time, it showed unemployment rising. How can this be happening at the same time? I asked Michael Farron, an economist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, to explain the Labor Department's jobs report. Many people would be surprised to find out that a rise in the unemployment rate is good news. But that seems to be what we're encountering with today's jobs report from the Department of Labor. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely. The fact that unemployment is rising is only a sign that more people are coming off of the sidelines and rejoining the labor force.
And we're talking with Michael Farron, who's a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, about the latest jobs report from the U.S. Department of Labor. What are some of the highlights in the report that you find significant?
Well, Rick, probably the biggest highlight is that 312,000 jobs were created last month, according to employer surveys. So when you factor that in with the increase in unemployment, that's why we can say that the fact that unemployment rose is actually a good thing, because unemployment is rising at the same time that enormous numbers of new jobs are being created. So that is implying that simply, rather than people losing jobs and then looking for work, it's pulling people out of the surplus workforce and off of the sidelines and into the economy.
The fact that there were so many people on the sidelines, as you say, does that suggest that the labor market is not as tight as it appears, and that might be an explanation for why wages have not been keeping up with job growth?
That's my explanation, yes. A lot of economists and people who follow the economy have been confused that with unemployment being so low that wages haven't been rising faster. But we have added an average of 220,000 new jobs to the economy every month over the last year. And that has happened in spite of wage growth not being particularly strong. So what that is telling you is that employers don't need to offer higher wages, at least at this point. We've started to see a slight rise over the past couple months of average wages, a little bit faster growth than what we've seen previously. But in general, what it seems to be is that there's still slack in the labor market.
Where are these jobs being created? Where are people being hired? What industries are standing out right now?
The professional services industry is always a big one that has shown a lot of growth consistently over year, month over month over the past year. Others are healthcare and construction, and honestly, it's happening pretty much everywhere in the economy, even in manufacturing, despite the tariffs and the trade war that's currently going on.
You skipped ahead to the next question I was going to ask, and that was whether the Trump administration's trade policy is an impediment to further job growth, that you know, we might be looking at even bigger numbers were it not for the tariffs and other barriers that are being erected. Is that true?
Certainly. Trade barriers always inhibit economic growth. And so the real question is, how much more growth would we be seeing over top of these already stellar numbers that we're currently seeing if we didn't have these headwinds that the economy is currently facing.
Now, does the December jobs report reflect the fact of holiday seasonal employment tends to fluctuate?
It does. These numbers are seasonally adjusted, so they it's not a perfect adjustment, but the BLS has been doing this for a while, so they've gotten pretty good at being able to incorporate the fact that holiday jobs are part of the equation.
So they know year after year that Hickory Farms is going to shut down right after Christmas.
Yes, definitely.
But these numbers don't reflect any effects of the partial government shutdown, do they? Those would be in next month's report.
That's correct. The way that these surveys are done is in the first part of each month, and so we will not see the effects of the government shutdown until next month's numbers are released at the beginning of February.
I'd like to dig a little deeper on the government shutdown, because we're really not talking about government workers losing their jobs, but the fact that they don't have money to spend affects the businesses around them, their landlords, the bills they have to pay. What effect could the shutdown have if it is extended beyond, well, today I guess it's in its 13th day, if it goes into a month or so, what kind of effect might that have on the economy and on the general jobs picture?
Well, you might see that the number of furloughed jobs in the next jobs report and the one after that would be higher than otherwise expected. But the fact of the matter is that a employer whose employees are providing services to the economy and to government employees in general as being part of the economy would not lay off employees just because they're seeing a short-term drop in business. Now, if we anticipated that the shutdown was going to last for 6 months or more, then you might see that kind of looking ahead behavior and, okay, I'm going to lay off some of my employees. But in most of our recent experiences, these government shutdowns have been relatively brief, and so it's unlikely that that employers should be reducing employment too much.
Are there any nuggets of information in the in this month's jobs report that may be overlooked by the news media in general, but that it kind of stands out to you because of your particular perspective on employment economics?
Well, if you look at the numbers a little bit more deeply than news stories are typically able to go, you find a really interesting sort of set of statistics in that the vast increase in employment, the 312,000 new jobs created, is mostly attributable to women, and the increase in unemployment is mostly attributable to men. So adult women's employment increased by almost 270,000 last month, and the number of unemployed adult women only increased by about 21,000, whereas adult men's employment dropped by 132,000, whereas the number of unemployed adult men increased by about 225,000. So what this is saying is it's kind of unusual that all of the growth, at least last month, or nearly all of it, seemed to come from women getting new jobs. And that actually is part of a larger trend that we've seen over the last year, where about 60% of the new jobs created have been filled by women.
That is an interesting statistic. Michael Farron, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your comments on the December jobs report from the Department of Labor, and we'll probably come back to you in months to come for more commentary, because this is a regular report.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BeringDrift.com.
When The Score returns, we'll revisit some of the highlights from last year, including clips from interviews with authors of books about various topics, as well as conversations we had with members of the Virginia General Assembly. The Score will be right back Don't touch that dial.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com. You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. This week, the Virginia General Assembly started its 400th annual session. That's right, the legislature began meeting regularly in 1619. Last year, I talked to several members of both the House of Delegates and the State Senate about legislation and politics. Here are some excerpts, beginning with State Senator Cree Deeds, who back in April correctly predicted that Democrats would pick up 3 congressional seats in the November elections. Do you think the blue wave that we saw in Virginia last year is going to continue in the congressional elections, the midterms this year?
I think it will. I think that the turnout you saw last week at the Democratic caucus here at Monticello High School, where they were expecting 300 to 600 people, and they had more than 1,300 people. In Charlottesville, they had, I think, 700 people. I mean, that sort of turnout, that sort of enthusiasm is what we're seeing all over the place, and I'd be very surprised if we don't pick up 2 or 3 congressional seats in Virginia.
Yeah, the energy is amazing out there right now, and we'll just see if it carries through to the fall. This is how it began last year with us in the House of Delegates. We were beginning to see these town hall meetings that were very, very large. And we weren't sure how extensive the wave would be, but it was really extensive in November, and I think it's going to hold for next November.
So I actually got it from a couple different places. There were Republicans that liked it. There were Green Party people that liked it. There were Libertarians that liked it. And all of us came together to work on that particular issue. And again, I think ranked choice voting has some real potential going forward. And we set up ranked choice voting the right way, which is to say that it doesn't have any sort of adverse effect on the Electoral College, which I think is an important component of our federal system. Unfortunately, it ended up dying in Finance Committee, of all places. We managed to get it through Privileges and Elections, which is very positive, because before legislation even close to something like this had died. And I think going forward, we're going to be able to provide localities the ability to have this option, especially for the sort of nonpartisan races that you see where 5 people are running for 3 seats. I think ranked choice voting is going to come in very handy. And it's really already being used by political parties for their own conventions and nominating contests.
Yeah, I do think we're going to come out with a budget. We're going to make sure that we do our fiscal responsibility. My problem is that I still think at this point it looks highly likely that Medicaid expansion is going to pass, and I think it's more effectively referred to as Obamacare expansion. And the problem at this point is Medicaid is increasingly failing to deliver on its promises to the most poor and vulnerable in our society, at the same time that it's busting budgets across the country right now. So my hope is that the work that I know many of myself and many of my colleagues are still doing behind the scenes will be enough to be able to get some people to reconsider their vote on that and find more fiscally responsible ways to be able to provide affordable and quality health care.
I think most of us on either side of the issue related to Medicaid expansion would hope we'd be able to conclude our work before the end of May or by the end of May, so local governments know what they're going to have related to state resources coming their way for education and other areas, public safety and the like. So that would be our goal. It looks like at this point, from my estimation, counting votes, that Medicaid expansion is going to happen. It's just a matter of when. So I hope that can be expedited, but I hope it's also done within the normal process. I've heard of, you know, some efforts to try to discharge committees from, you know, their work and the like, and I would hope that neither the House or Senate would go down that road, because that's, I think it sets a bad precedent. There's no need for committees if we're just going to allow the full General Assembly, or, you know, House or Senate, to vote on things without having those issues go before what is the workhorse of the General Assembly, and that is the committee structure.
Well, I think that's a very valid point. You know, the founders of Uber and Lyft probably have very little philosophically in common with me, but by the same token, I mean, it is a revolutionary free market enterprise, and I work very closely with some of those entities and carried legislation that that created a framework for transportation networking companies to actually be able to legally operate in Virginia. I think that's really critical. Government has no place deciding winners and losers. This whole notion that we ought to be selling taxicab medallions and outlawing things like Uber and Lyft is just wrong-headed.
And unfortunately, I think our current governor has kind of lost his way in the way the Senate works and how we do business. And I'll give you an example, and maybe it's my own personal bias right now because I'm a little pissed off at the governor. Vetoed some very reasonable legislation that came out of the Senate 40-0, which means all of my Senate colleagues, all, that includes all the Democrats, voted for some reasonable legislation that would help working Virginia families who are paying those high premiums in Charlottesville, right, access to insurance. Not Medicaid, because they don't qualify for Medicaid. They don't qualify for the assistance to get one of the Obamacare plans. So they're stuck in the individual marketplace, and they can't afford it. The premiums are too high, and this would have been a fix for them. And he's more worried about Medicaid expansion than he is about people who are paying premiums. And that really irritates me, because those folks need help too. And it's not a perfect fix, and we've acknowledged it's not. And until my colleagues like Tom and the rest of those guys up here either fix, repeal, whatever they're going to do, the states are going to get stuck with it. And we are coming up with the solutions in a bipartisan manner. And if you'd remember where he came from in the Senate, when you get 19 Democrats from the Senate, the bill comes out 40-0, that should say to me as a leader, hey, there's support for this.
Yeah.
Not, oh, it's a political thing, and I'm going to use it to bend over your head so you'll vote for something else I really want.
Well, the biggest bill I worked on, it was a 12-year project, and it hadn't looked like it was going very far, and then last year we got closer and actually passed, and the governor vetoed it. But it's this issue of restitution that crime victims receive as part of the court case. And so for years and years, judges have said, as part of the sentence, I sentence you to 2 years in prison. When you get out, you have to pay the medical bills or something like that. And what we found is that we'd heard anecdotally that year by year, a lot of that was not getting paid, but we never had a sort of a grip on the size of the problem. The Crime Commission did a year-long study and found, to just our stupefaction, that it was $230 million unpaid overdue restitution bills. And it was no singular thing. It wasn't being tracked very well. It wasn't being recorded. People were leaving probation without ever having it assessed. Judges didn't know. Add all that together, and it comes out to $230 million. Now, some of that would never get paid no matter what you did. The defendant is serving a life sentence, or he's dead or disabled or something that will make it impossible. Leaving all that aside, it is certainly, surely, many tens of millions of dollars that victims were counting on that never got paid. And then in the course of that, we found a second problem, completely unrelated, which is that we had over $8 million that had been paid, and we lost track of the victims. And it was just sitting in various government coffers around the state, and literally nothing was happening. No one was looking for them. No one was making any effort. It took a reporter from a TV station in Richmond to say she found the first million. And we said, oh, my gosh, and we did our own study and found $8 million. So we fixed that, too. And some of it's just record-keeping. You make sure that every time a judge orders it, he will actually have it written down. They'll keep track of it. They'll score it. Then if it's collected, we're going to make it all trickle down to a place in Richmond that keeps looking for people. And then we're going to have judges keep track. And so before you get off probation, if you still owe money, you're going back before the judge, and the judge can decide to keep you on probation or find out some other way to collect the money. He is allowed to say, this is unrecoverable, we'll never see it. It doesn't mean that court order isn't in place, but at least we clear you off the docket for the next case. But that was my biggest concern, and we have been working on it for many years. Frankly, wasn't sure it would ever pass. That's something that I'm pretty proud of from this year.
With Luis Lucas and Bill Carrico both carrying casino bills, I think it's reasonable that the legislation will get a fair hearing this year. I think that Chap Peterson and Mark Sickles have sports gaming bills in, so I think those bills, given this, what the Supreme Court ruling this past spring and the action in other states, I think it's reasonable to think those bills will get be heard and have support on both sides of the aisle. The casino bills, so I think because of the pressure from Southwest Virginia, from Bristol, and the pressure from Southeast Virginia, Portsmouth, I think that those bills have a chance of going forward, particularly with the fact that some of our Indian tribes are now nationally recognized, and in some Indian lands, you've got a real chance to have a casino in one of those. I think as one of the questions tonight was about the potential for revenue. Mm-hmm. And I think it's got to be something we explore. Is it something that's going to pass? I don't know. I think there will probably be people in both the Democratic and Republican caucuses in the Senate anyway that fall on both sides of the issue. I don't anticipate that we would take a caucus position. In fact, I've been a member of the Democratic caucus in the Senate for nearly, 18 years, and I can tell you that there are very few times that we have hold their feet to the fire. You know, we're going to take a caucus position. People in general vote as they see fit.
That last voice was Senator Creed Deeds talking about gambling legislation. He was preceded by Delegate David Toscano, Delegate Nick Freitas, Delegate Steve Landis, Senator Mark Obenchain, Senator Bryce Reeves, and Delegate Rob Bell.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Over the past year, I had the opportunity to talk to a number of authors on a wide range of topics. We had clips from some of those authors last week, and here are some more, beginning with Emily Dufton explaining the difference between decriminalization and legalization of marijuana.
Decriminalization means that you can be caught with the drug, assuming it's not a huge amount, you're not like actively trafficking it, and it's kind of a civil fine. It's like a traffic ticket or a parking ticket or something like that. But that means that there's also no regulation or oversight. The black market continues to exist. Corner dealers aren't exactly checking people's IDs and things like that. Legalization is a more official standard system for the growth, sale, distribution, and control of the drug. So in a lot of ways, it's much better. Rates of adolescent marijuana use in legalized states have either remained static or have actually dropped because, dispensaries have bouncers in front of them. You have to show your ID. It's very contained, whereas you just don't have those same levels of oversight and regulation and decriminalization.
I think that there will be two things. One, the only president to resign, of course, is always going to be the footnote until we get three or four more to resign, in which case he'll just be the first. I think that his foreign policy vision was pretty amazing. He saw very early on the growth of the computer age and that information societies in Japan and Korea and around the Asian Rim would be built on an intellectual nimbleness and not on monolithic, communistic, mechanistic factory plan, five-year plans. But he also saw that unless Red China was integrated into this, that this whole thing could be snuffed in the cradle. And that, I think, is the great contribution that he made to mankind. 50 years later, China is a peaceful player on the world stage, has managed to bring its people, raise their standard of living without going to war, without bringing conflict. And I think that people will look back and they won't say, oh my God, this was a strike of genius that came out of nowhere. A lot of American foreign policy experts were advocating this, but Nixon pulled it off. He was the one who saw the time was right, struck, and did it deftly enough that it worked.
So it's kind of incredible, looking at the dissent within the country. This was, we'd never really achieved national unity. And if anything, during the war itself, the Wilson administration, which was a leftist administration, effectively waged a war against the far left. Mm-hmm. So you had the Red Scare and the crackdown. You know, this fear that the Bolsheviks had arrived on our shores. And Mitchell Palmer, who was the attorney general, went on this incredible, you could never see something like this happening today, I hope, where he went and rounded up all the Reds, and without much due process at all. And fortunately, they did deport some of them, but the acting department, the head of the Labor Department, Secretary of Labor, Lewis Post, began throwing out all the cases out, because the Department of Labor at that point controlled Ellis Island. And he was looking at all these cases and like, there's no due process here, there's no warrants, and whatnot. And he was like, okay, we're letting all these people go. But it's just incredible. There was no guardrails at that time. We really had not addressed, had any significant First Amendment cases, not until 1919.
Right.
Yeah. The ACLU didn't exist yet. That's the American Civil Liberties Union.
The 100th anniversary of the ACLU is coming up in 2020.
Yeah, and it's a result of the war. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant guardrail in our society. But leading up into the war itself, none of those guardrails existed. It was just kind of incredible, like, to think a century ago.
I showed up at Emancipation Park just a few minutes after 9, and I just started shooting because I wasn't sure if I was sort of late to the game, and I just started clicking away. And ironically or appropriately, one of the first people who came into my viewfinder was James Alex Fields. And as I reviewed my photos, it's funny, I don't think I even reviewed them until midday Sunday. And then I saw them, and I had numerous shots of him. Shots of him just sort of hanging out in the park, and shots of him chanting some of the "commie scum off our streets" type slogans that the alt-right were using that morning. And I had concurrent audio recordings, so I could actually say with authority that he was chanting "commie scum off our streets," because I could match the timestamps. And the timestamps proved really crucial in putting the book together. I was able to compare my photography and my audio recordings with live stream. That's mm-hmm. what I'm looking for, live stream. A guy named Ford Fisher of News to Share did a very long live stream, and so did Russia Today, or Ruptly, I'm not sure exactly. They're always credible in everything they do, but on a live stream, you can compare their images with things that you saw and with other people's images, and you can come to a pretty good understanding of what took place.
Well, when rail transit was developed, most urban jobs were factory jobs, and most factories were downtown. And Henry Ford's moving assembly line required too much space, and so factories moved to the suburbs as early as the 1920s. And then in the 1980s, most jobs went from being factory jobs to being service jobs, healthcare, education, retail, wholesale. And those jobs are spread out all across the landscape. They aren't just in suburban downtowns or other centers. And so transit doesn't work well at all for those kinds of jobs. And we're talking about 70% of jobs in most urban areas is just totally inaccessible to by transit.
It seems like three things are going on at once. The first is our expectations change. As we get to midlife, we realize that achievement is not going to bring us the satisfaction that we expected when we were young. When we're kids, young people in our 20s, we overestimate how happy we'll become if we achieve social status. And that's what motivates us. That's how evolution says, you know, hey, Rick, sincere, go out and do great things and get lots of status and mating opportunities. But then we discover evolution moves the goalposts so that each time we get status, we want even more. So by our 40s, we're getting pretty tired of this, and we think we'll never be satisfied. So that's the first thing. But our expectations readjust as we learn that. A second thing that happens is our values change as we age. That's a big part of the picture. As we age, we're less inclined to chase shiny, glittery objects like success and status. And we reorient more toward community and connection, the important interpersonal ties in life, which turn out to be a much more reliable way to achieve lasting satisfaction. And the third thing that goes on is that our brains actually change. As we age, we become less prone to regret. We become more positive in outlook. We feel less stress. Even in a comparable situation, we feel less stress. And all of these things seem to work together to make this kind of transition in the middle of life, when we're moving from the early part, which is very ambitious and achievement-oriented, toward the latter part, when we're more focused on connection and community. And there's this rough transition in the middle.
Essentially, I raised that question of what keeps people trapped in poverty. I think both the right and left have gotten this wrong. On the right, it's largely been a question of the poor themselves, bad decisions they've made, bad choices, not working, not dropping out of school, getting pregnant when you're not married. And on the left, it's been more talk about the structures of society, racism, gender discrimination, economic dislocation, and so on. There's a little bit of truth to both of those issues. But I suggest there's a third villain in this, and that is government policies themselves. Too much of what government does actually prevents the poor from becoming active participants in a growing economy.
One of the longest-standing DARPA projects was called Project Seesaw, which was the idea of creating a particle beam that was going to blast missiles out of space, you know, protect the United States. But it was never going to work technologically, and so it went on. It was getting funding for 10 or 15 years, and a program manager told me this great story of how he tried to kill it. He assembled this group of scientists who knew about the particle beam, because it was all quite top secret, to explain why it was technologically unfeasible. And one of the major reasons was, to power the particle beam, you'd basically need the entire electricity grid of the United States. And so one of the scientists on this panel came up with this proposal to put nuclear weapons under the Great Lakes, to set off the nuclear weapons, drain the Great Lakes, to create the energy needed to power the particle beam. And this DARPA employee thought, great, everyone will see how ridiculous it is. And he looked around the room, and all the scientists were nodding that head, saying, you know, my God, that could work. That's one favorite story. One of my favorites is the idea of a nuclear-powered spaceship, Project Orion, which was going to be traveled to the stars powered by the explosion of thermonuclear weapons. One of the scientists who worked on it estimated that a single launch, mission launch, you know, setting off these thermonuclear weapons, would kill, on average, 10 people on Earth from fallout. President Kennedy saw a mock-up of this spaceship with its 500 nuclear weapons and was apparently pretty aghast. Those are a couple of my favorite DARPA projects, and on sort of the bad range of shockingly bad.
That was Sharon Weinberger talking about the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA. The other voices you heard were Emily Dufton, John Farrell on Richard Nixon, Garrett Peck on World War I, Hawes Spencer on Charlottesville Summer of Hate, Randall O'Toole on Rail Transit, Jonathan Rauch on The Happiness Curve, and Michael Tanner on The Inclusive Economy. Almost 9 years ago, I had a chance to speak to transportation expert Wendell Cox about high-speed rail after he gave a presentation at the Heritage Foundation. Transportation is a perennial subject of discussion in legislation, so this week's featured interview from the archives is Wendell Cox.
Just start by stating your name and your position.
Wendell Cox, principal of Demographia and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
Okay, great. If you could just sum up in a few words what your presentation was about today.
Essentially that the push toward high-speed rail has considerable problems. One of them is that most of what is being proposed isn't even high-speed rail. It's really very slow rail, comparatively speaking. But even the high-speed rail part of it is greatly overstated in terms of its potential. It does not achieve the environmental benefits that are claimed. It will not reduce traffic congestion on the highways. It will not reduce airport congestion. And it is exceedingly costly.
One of the things you said in there was rather intriguing about the paradox that high-speed rail may actually increase traffic congestion. Can you explain that?
Yeah, because a lot of the systems that are being proposed would put new passenger trains on existing freight rail. That will make it more difficult for the freight rail systems to operate efficiently. No country in the world has a first-class passenger system and a first-class freight system. We have a first-class freight system, which keeps our truck congestion much lower than you see in Europe or Japan. There is the potential that passenger trains could interfere with the operation of the freights, making the freight systems less competitive in the long run, which would increase traffic congestion.
What is the environmental impact of high-speed rail?
Really none. The claim is that it will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. To do that, it has to get a lot of people out of cars and planes. It won't do that. But more importantly, the greenhouse gas emissions are very high from these systems. The difference between them and cars and airplanes is not that significant. Our work in California suggests that the cost per ton of greenhouse gas emissions removed by high-speed rail would be on the order of $1,800. The IPCC says we ought not to spend more than $50 per ton. University of California study suggests that the California high-speed rail system would take 71 years to pay back the greenhouse gas emissions that are used in construction. So it really is not the environmental winner that a lot of people say that it is.
You put up a chart that showed the subsidies for different modes of transportation. Can you just briefly explain how the subsidies vary from mode to mode?
Yeah, what you have is at the federal level, for example, based upon federal data, we actually make about a penny profit per passenger mile in the highway program. Transit, we lose about 16 cents per passenger mile. That is to say, the subsidies are about 16 cents per passenger mile, and passenger rail Amtrak about a 25% subsidy, 25 cents subsidy, excuse me. And on airlines, the subsidy is about 0.4 cents, which could be very easily wiped out with, you know, fee changes and all of that kind of thing.
Are you aware of any potential high-speed rail projects in Virginia that my readers in particular might be interested in?
Well, we have plans by the Department of Transportation in Virginia to improve freight, to improve passenger rail on a number of corridors, Richmond, Washington. There's also plans to improve service down to Charlotte and over to Virginia Beach, Norfolk, and so on. So, yes, I know those, however, are the kinds of programs where they would be sharing freight rail. They would be slow systems. They would be slower than driving. They would not be competitive with driving at all.
Would they incur a substantial taxpayer subsidy?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can expect that they will cost an awful lot of money to build and to operate after that.
Any final thoughts you've got about the presentation you just made and what impact it might have on policy? Do you think you can change people's minds?
All of us who are in public policy would like to think that we can help to change people's minds toward better solutions. And one of the things that I'm certainly hopeful for is that the kinds of data that we show can work in that direction.
The question was asked whether data and statistics makes any difference given the mindset of the current administration. Do you think it can?
Well, first of all, this program is going to live long beyond the current administration, and that doesn't matter whether the current administration is reelected or not. I mean, this is a long-term program. This country faces a depth of financial crisis the likes of which it has never seen before, and we can see a change, I think, in the mood of the people. Right now, despite the fact that $8 billion is a lot of money, it's still pretty small compared to what would be required to do anything major in terms of this kind of rail expansion. And I would hope in the long run, better minds and clearer minds will prevail, and this kind of investment, it's not even an investment because it's virtually all lost, will not be made.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You bet.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends about The Score, and be sure to leave your comments on our website at BeringDrift.com.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.